All right, welcome everybody. Tonight we have a special Parsha class. This week is Parsha Shoftim, which of course is a Torah portion that deals with the legal, the system of law, the judicial system, as well as law enforcement. And if there was a more burning issue in America today, I don't know what it is, but the topic of defunding the police or not. Ever since the protests about all the violence, police violence, the issue of defunding the police has escalated to the degree that many municipalities are implementing to varying degrees. And what I want to do, I typically have a, as we introduced the Parsha with a video, but I said, we have fantastically talented people at MJE. So we're going to have our MJE-er to be our introduction to the topic. So again, just to be very clear, the goal here, instead of shouting at each other, which is much of the conversations around these types of topics in America, we're going to try to learn. We're trying to learn the positions of both sides as best as can be represented in the limited time that we have. And what our goal for tonight is to show what the Torah has to say about these topics. What it has to say about how do we balance the various needs and elements that our whole society needs to have a harmonious society. The Torah, of course, is in favor of having not only shalom bias in your house, but shalom bias in your entire society. Easier said than done. So we're going to explore that tonight. We're going to see a little bit of the Parsha. And so we're going to get into it. This is how we're going to do. I'm going to give, I've asked Simone to present as best she can. And I'm now going to say, I'm going to help everybody out. The positions that the people are presenting may not be, they fully embrace themselves. They're just doing it necessarily to educate everybody. So I'm not, where everybody can be neutral as Switzerland here. Simone, who has extensive, as part of the Marshall Project, extensive, doing a lot of journalistic work about law enforcement in general, to present that the police should be defunded. All right, so which I'm gonna help out frame a little bit, which means by and large, which is gonna take a portion or a substantial portion of the police force and put it into various social services which are there to help communities and therefore alleviate and promote well-being in the society. And we use that as sort of a vague-ish definition. I'm gonna turn over to Simone to give us 3 minutes of why people who are on the side believe this is a fantastic idea, as well as, in actuality, many municipalities right now. So without further ado, Simone.
Thank you. I wanted to start off to say the caveat, I am not a defund the police person, and I'm going to go very quickly on the three categories. I fall in the camp of reimagining police, which is a term now used in academia, and we're lucky to have an academic too on this panel who could talk about that. But so we have three camps: reimagining police, which is something progressive police chiefs openly embrace, academics embrace. Sort of the middle is defund. And yes, there's something left to defund. Just get rid of them, abolitionists who don't want cops at all. So we understand that camp. They're a little wacky, so I'll take them off the table. So the difference between defund and reimagine. So both camps agree that policing is just doing too much today. I've done reporting looking at Memphis and Chicago and found that over 90% of 911 calls in those cities have nothing to do with violent crime. It's burglar alarm, dogs, homeless people on benches. If you really go through a 911 database, which I have, it's not shootings, it's not robberies, it's more or less BS. And a lot of people in both reimagining and defund are like, why are cops answering barking dogs or car alarms or house alarms or even things like a fender bender? Why do we have to send cops to do minor crimes or things that aren't really crime at all? So policing, a really quick recap, which I know other people on the panel can talk about. we cut social services over the years. So back in the good old days of the booming 90s, maybe you had social workers who would go out and help a mentally ill person or deal with more social service issues. But with budget cuts, remember the Great Recession of 2008, a lot of those quality of life issues fell into the police. Once cities start cutting budgets, the cops are left to sort of clean up the crap. So people in both reimagining and defunding are like, well, why do we have cops dealing with the mentally ill, social services, you know, going after crazy dogs? Let's reimagine police or defund police. Take away in New York alone, it's about $6 billion. How can we take money from that camp and reallocate it to other services? Someone needs to mute.
Got me.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other rationale for their position? Is that the primary reason?
Basically, bottom line, cops are doing too much. They're not chasing violent crime anymore. Take money out of their budgets. Give it to like social service programs so cops aren't doing everything these days.
But aren't they also saying that they're not only not doing too much, they're also not doing it well? I mean, of course, they're also claiming the fact is that there's a trend of some levels of either systemic racism or overt racism, and that's also not promoting the well-being of society. Is that also not part of their
argument? So the Washington Post won a Pulitzer a couple years ago looking into police shootings and found nearly one-third of police killings involve someone with mental illness. So people in this camp are like, if so many people being shot and killed by police are people of color, and a lot of those people of color have schizophrenia, bipolar, and you know they hit a wall and the cops show up because the social service worker is not going to show up at midnight, things escalate, boom. Policing are blue collar. These are things I've written about. They're not white collar professionals. They're not getting their PhDs. A lot of them don't have law degrees. I know Stephanie had mentioned in the previous class, she had worked in a town where actually a lot of them were highly educated, but most of America, they're not. So you're dealing, I did a story looking at the intersection of being a war veteran and being a cop. And I found that 20% of working cops report to have a military background. So one fifth of American police, according to data I crunched, the US Census say, they served in a war. So is that like the population we want responding to a homeless person chasing a job? So policing has really taken this left turn, and I'm not blaming the cops at all. I'm blaming cities. Okay. Cities, because of budget cuts in the past, they never really fulfilled. Like, why are school safeties officer cops? Like, why do they have guns? Why are people answering 911 calls for the mentally ill? Why aren't they social workers? Well, you know, in the 90s and early aughts, a lot of those programs were cut and they never replaced them. So now in this conversation, and I also want to say, a lot of this is politics. I was working on stories during the height of the coronavirus about how are cops going to reshape, because budget cuts were coming anyway before George Floyd. And I was working on a story about the intersection of virtual reality and policing. So cops knew this was coming in May and June. They were bracing for the cuts. So this is not, I know in politics, like Trump is, oh, it's crime and the Democrats are crazy. No. Cities across the country have lost a lot of money, a lot of revenue. So police departments were preparing to face cuts anyway. Now, to save face, they're like, oh, we're doing it because of the George Floyd protests. My reporting shows, no, they were going to do it anyway. So I also think that's misleading. Policing has become insanely politicized right now.
Okay, we're going to get to the insanely politicized problem. All right, we're going to turn over to Stephanie. Why do you feel the defund police movement is misguided or wrong? Or insane, depending, you know, whatever position you want to take.
Okay, so this is the position I'm taking here. So there are several points. One is we, as a Jewish community, right, to kind of think about how we view police and our relationship with police, and then I'll go more macro. But to start within our own community, we as a Jewish community, and not just Jewish communities, but faith communities generally, are facing an increased threat because of the rise of white supremacy here in America. And so we've seen shootings at synagogues, at mosques, at churches over the past several years, and a need for greater security on these levels. Additionally, we've seen school shootings. And so one of the things that we hear often And so those are, right, that's a need. That there's a need for safety, there's a need for security. A lot of what we see police departments do, and Simone and I actually might agree on the, well, in real life, we actually pretty much totally agree on this, but let's just, on this point, we actually might agree on some of it in saying that, like, part of police departments' roles are quality of life and ensuring the safety and security of the people in their community. And the question is how they do it. And not necessarily that they need less money to do it or that we need to cut the service. We just need to be smarter in how we're doing it, right? And so what are those things? Right now, there's no nationalized training program, right? And so the question and what we're seeing, and we heard, I think yesterday I watched on MSNBC, Art Acevedo, who's the Houston police chief, said very publicly, what happened to George Floyd was horrific. It should never have happened in a police department. And there are police officers and police leadership across the country that say the same thing. And the problem is that we cannot blame all police departments on the actions. And how do we deal with the root of the problem? Right. And so what we see, and to quote Simone from a past class, right, is we see veteran police officers who don't have new training. And then we see new police officers, some of which are veterans, recently coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, probably with some PTSD issues that are not dealt with because our VA is defunded or underfunded, and they're not getting the services and resources they need. And so we're not providing them the training to do their job. And we're not giving them the resources they need as police officers. Should we have more militarized police? No, but that doesn't mean that we need to defund the police department. Couple of other things. One of the things we heard at the New York City Council when they were trying to, there were efforts to defund the police from political activists, and again, this goes back to the politics of it, from political activists, but not necessarily community activists. Right? It wasn't the people that normally are coming up to civic association meetings or community board meetings or really dealing with the issues and safety of their neighborhoods. It was people who were, frankly, jumping on a bandwagon and the messaging of a bandwagon. And what we heard from some people who were community activists who were involved in community policing programs, where you have a police officer that, or several police officers that are in neighborhoods, where people become familiar with those police officers, is that those programs work. And those are not the programs we want to defund. And especially when there are high drug rates in neighborhoods, or there are high dropout rates in neighborhoods, in bringing these programs in and giving people that reinforcement of positive relationships with police actually is proven to help. One of the other pieces of that, though, is that we also have police departments across the United States, particularly in cities, where we have police officers that don't live in the community that they serve. And so instead of saying it's actually that we need to defund the police, thinking about how we reform police departments and make sure that police officers are accountable because they're members of the same communities that they're serving. We also need to do a better job at, there are racism issues in our country for sure. And there's racism within police departments. Most police departments don't look like the people they serve. And so we need to do a better job in increasing the diversity of our police departments and also in sensitivity and diversity trainings, not just about race, but around sexual trauma and sexual assault and all kinds of various issues. Could there be more social workers involved in that work? Absolutely. But does it mean that we should be defunding police departments? No. These are responsibilities and we need in this kind of changing times. And we've seen crime increase in New York City area and other large cities over the last few months. And not just because of protests, but crime is increasing. And so we need to make sure that we have a plan and we have police departments that are working through these plans. Part of the problem, I think, and I would say I have a similar resolution, is that the politics creates part of the problem. And if we would all kind of sit down together and figure out what are the priorities of our police departments and how do we go about solving them and fixing the problems instead of using phrases like drastic defunding measures, I think we would probably all be on a closer to the same page.
Well, Stephanie, you really made the case for a really increased funding for the police to be able to better training and to both insofar as you know, to deal with the you know, to do what they're doing, but just do it better, and not just to cut their budget. Because first of all, you could also, and I think I said from you that the police do not cause the violence. They're oftentimes respond to the violence, and that violence is there. So we need just people who are better trained, more effective to deal with it. And if that's going to be a social worker, great. If it's going to be a police officer, also great. Who can help out in the situation? Is that basic?
Yeah, but we should also look at civilian roles within police departments, right? And we should not everyone has to be out there on the street. And the other piece is that it's reallocation of resources within the police department, right? A few years ago, and I don't know what the impetus was, Simone probably does, right? What we saw in Ferguson, right, going back like right to 2016, is what we saw in Ferguson was military grade vehicles, right, storming the streets of Ferguson, which, by the way, Ferguson is a suburb, like, fact. And so then after it, it became like a gadget, kind of, in a way, that all these police departments were like, we need to have militarized vehicles. We need to have SWAT teams. We need to have helicopters. We need to have boats, whatever it is, depending on the jurisdiction they're serving. And the reality is that there isn't a need for those in police departments. And so if we actually spent the dollars that were allocated to police resources in a more responsible way, then we wouldn't even need to have conversations about defunding police, because part of the reason that this conversation is taking place is because of a militarization of police departments.
Okay. Well, we are. So to close out our perspective, we call upon Dr. Keith, a.k.a. we like to call him Desi Grant, from John Jay School of Criminology, to share his, you know, just give us 2 minutes. We had two beautiful presentations from Simone and Stephanie. Share some things that people don't know about this conversation that you think will be very helpful for us to understand it better, conceptualize and understand the thing. And then we're going to get into the terror part, because the terror also has much to say on this important topic.
Yeah, thank you, Rabbi. First, I want to say both sides were amazing and really got to the core, I think, of both perspectives. I think, Simone, you hit the nail on the head with the idea that whether you're an academic or you're a police executive of some level, no one's going to disagree with the argument that the police are doing too much in society today. I mean, as you describe, police are called, you know, have had to take on the roles of mental health counselors, social workers, all of that we've acknowledged for quite some time. And we know when we look at problem-oriented policing or crime prevention, what works is where the police are involved with multiple sectors of society and playing that role of brokering what's going on. That's what ultimately leads to crime reductions in the long run. And we can't ignore the fact that, particularly here in New York City, but across the country as well, there's been an ongoing crime decline. Here in New York City, we've seen what's called the New York crime miracle. So something has gone right here in New York that we have to look at and understand. Why has crime gone down here? And most research, although it's hard to prove conclusively, most research would argue that the NYPD definitely played a role in some of what's going on here. And I think our arguments of defunding the police in the context, and Stephanie hit on this, defunding the police at a time when New York City is no longer experiencing that miracle. We're seeing a very drastic move in the other direction of violent crime going up again. So maybe it's not the time to think about this idea of defunding. And if we're realistic about defunding, it's saying, yes, we'll take money from the police here in New York. We're talking about $1 billion from the police budget. We have a huge police budget and dedicate it to other things. It sounds good in principle, but that's not how it will manifest in reality. Is not so good, because where is that money going to come from in the police budget? And I say that rhetorically, but it's almost all of it's going to come from overtime and police resource, like personnel resources. So what you're saying is you're going to take away police presence or resource in the community at a time when it's our successful outcomes or impacts are now going in the other direction. It really doesn't make sense. And there's, if we unpack it, am I going too far, Rabbi?
No, you're good. So you have to conclude.
If we unpack it a little bit, I'll try to wrap with this idea. If we unpack it even further, the declines will, I just lost some of where I was going with it. So one of the problems that's causing the tensions between police and community that were out there, George Floyd being the most recent powder keg, which certainly, I don't know if it was Stephanie or Simone mentioned, is not representative of policing across the country. I do work with the Metropolitan Police in London, and even there, they're experiencing the backlash of George Floyd. All police are being blamed for this. But there's a divide from police and community, and we experienced that for a long time before that incident. And we've seen throughout the history of policing, in the 70s and 80s, we thought we'll be more effective in policing if we put them in patrol cars, you know, to respond to crime, for example. And that was proven to not make a difference at all. And at the same time, it increased, took the police away from the community. So the problems just got worse and worse and worse. And now we're facing similar issues of a lack of a legitimacy, a lack of relationship. And we're talking about taking away the resources that allow the police to be in the community, to do the community policing that Stephanie was talking about. So it's very counterintuitive. The reactionary left wants to say, defund the police without thinking what's going on from the crime perspective I was mentioning before, but also this relational perspective. And if I have time on one last point to hit on,
you get in there,
the one thing Simone mentioned that's very, very counterintuitive, but so right and so important is most police are not responding to violent crime. That is true. That's an absolute fact. And so shown throughout the history of policing, most police in the course of their whole career don't even take out their gun. And yet we're painting them as this is true. But yet we're painting them as this horrible menace of violent people. They get in situations because we need them when we are experiencing trauma or crime, or as Stephanie nicely talked about, you know, the Jewish community and the anti-Semitism and everything that's meant, we want the police there. And the truth is the community, the minority communities that are protesting against the police rightfully in some respects, you know, I'm keeping a short discussion here, also want the police there. If you talk to them, I think that's what Simone was also hinting at. They don't want you to take them away because they provide security. Stephanie was talking about this. So it's all counterintuitive, and this is the politics. And unfortunately, criminal justice is one of the places where we get the politics all wrong all the time. From the left for sure to the right. I mean, we don't properly use evidence to strategize. The facts are all there. You guys nicely summarized a lot of the main ideas, but will that lead to the right kind of change? I don't know. I don't necessarily have faith in it, but I hope I gave you some ways of thinking that drew upon what you guys were talking about nicely.
Thank you so much. Fantastic. So, all right. So we're going to continue on. We are going to now tackle what the terror has to deal with, because on the left side, they're saying you're being wrong-minded. You're focusing on the results of the problem. You're not dealing with the problem, which is people do not have proper education. People have mental health issues, and you're going to send guys down there well armed to deal with problems and you're going to have explosion situations. That's the one hand. On the other hand, you're saying, the right will say, that's very nice, you live in a very beautiful world there, but the bottom line is, when there is significant issues, you need the police, and you need them well-trained, and you need them coming on time. And not, if you're going to cut the budget of $1 million of the New York City Police, you're going to have delay in response times, and you're going to have starts. So I would like to I would say, as best we can do in about a half an hour, sort of capture a very complex topic. We're now going to sort of see how the Torah deal with this whole area. So I want to get to some of the learning component.
I just want to correct something you said. It's not the response times that's the issue with the cutting of the funding. that may be affected somewhat, but that's not what drives crime and crime rates. The problem I feel in this situation is the lack of police presence in communities.
Uh-huh. Even though the general presence before is the problem.
It's going to go away. Yeah.
The preemptive, sort of like the deterrent factor, their presence being in the community.
Factor, but also the relational factor of citizens and police knowing each other. Which is what
the whole community policing component. That would be correct. Excellent. All right. So what would the Torah say about all this whole conversation over here? It would say, I'm going to quote we have to have a video because I'm just a rule of thumb in my classes. So this is the response to the
and there is more to life than talk. You should know what's going on in the outside world.
Careful, my paper.
Why should I break my head about the outside world? Let the outside world break its own head.
Well put.
He's right. As the good book says, if you spit in the air, it lands in your face.
Nonsense.
You can't close your eyes to what's happening in the world.
He's right.
He's right and he's right. They can't both be right.
You know, you are also right.
He is right.
All right, so we have here, so in classic Fiddler on the Roof style, since everything's been politicized, there are valid points that the left is making, and there are valid points that the right are making, and it's not this simple division between law and order and you know, versus not law and order. These false things are not true. So let's get to some of our information here. So number one, let's take a look. It's a Gemara in Kedushin. Okay, let me just get bear with me for 1 second. Okay. So to understand some of the background, let's take a look here at some of the sources here. Our first source is from the Talmud, the Gemara Kedushin here. So let's have somebody read. Let me have Sarah Lewison, Bakasha. Just unmute yourself.
That would be helpful.
Good.
Yes. Okay. We're on 40B.
Yeah.
And there already was an incident in which Rabbi Tarfon and the elders were reclining in the loft of the house of Nitza and Lod. When this question was asked of them, is study greater or is action greater? Rabbi Tarfon answered and said, action is greater. Rabbi Akiva answered and said, study is greater. Everyone answered and said, study is greater as study leads to action.
Oh. Okay, classic. So according to the Talmud, what is the true cause of proper behavior?
Study.
Study. In other words, you have to know, you have to learn the values, virtues, how to live life in a proper manner. So you cannot do that without an education. That's it. So, and how does study lead to proper behavior?
So it affects who you are as a person.
Right. So whether you're being taught by your parents or your teachers, they're inculcating with you the core values. Now, just to clarify, does the study mean memorizing the rules? Is that study?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think it actually relates very closely to what David was just saying, that, you know, all of these decisions are being made by politics and not because people are spending the time to really study and look at the research. And so if we used study and research and, you know, data, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. And then that led to what we should then do. And I think part of this, obviously, this is probably not the example they were thinking of, but
That's on a macro level. But how about on a personal level? Let's say on the Stephanie Hausner level. What has study done for you?
It has impacted the actions that I take, right? Like if I study the laws of Shabbat, it changes how I observe Shabbat.
Well, is it now? So that's the question: if you just that gets into the question about what is study? In other words, I'm going to go to question number four. Give an example of such a study which would change a non-observant energy behavior on Shabbat. In other words, would it just be, here are the rules of Shabbat? 1, 2, 4, 12, 4, 13. In fact, it would probably turn them off.
What kind of study are we talking about? Well, don't you have to want to study? Like, doesn't it require you to, like, and this is really geared towards the right and the left right now, because study means that you acknowledge you don't know everything and there's much to learn, which is something I think the loud voices in politics have forgotten. Yeah. So, like, if you are putting the time and effort into studying, it's an acknowledgement that you are not perfect and you don't always know what the answer is.
That's true. Now, but we talk about study. There's various aspects of study. One aspect of study is just sort of that classic book learning, formal learning. But then there's a more of a, we just go from the MG experience for a moment. There is an inspiring kind of study, which creates an inner motivation to lead a different life. That's not just simply a book study. That's a non-formal education. That's inspiring education. It has much components. So we're talking about a study that leads to action means it's a study whose emotional impact is such that it makes a person decide that I want to live a different life.
Can I say something? Okay. So, and this is common. I'm going to speak about Judaism and policing. So, and I think David can speak to this. Academics and even me as an investigative reporter, I don't have policy decision. I am considered an expert in like police reform, and so David is too, but I don't get to sit at the table at like New York City Council and go, actually, no, in 1987 after the Supreme Court did this, so don't pass this law. So sometimes when you study and you're an expert, if you don't have authority, our action is meaningless. My action is to write a news article. Do people listen? I don't know. And then it also reminds me, like me and my Harusa, we were doing Mishnah studying, and then we decided to move on to the Rambam because as we delve deeper into Mishnah studying, I felt it doesn't really apply to us anymore. The Mishnah is this super old. Judaism and Halakha has changed so much since it was written. We're studying this. There's no action. All the things we're learning has nothing to do with 2020. So yeah. Sometimes I don't agree with that statement. Sometimes action is more important than study.
If you put yourself in a like lawmaker's position, right? If I'm sitting at the city council table, then I'm taking in what I'm hearing from the police chief, from experts, from articles, from constituents, from different pieces. And so I also view study as like hearing different voices or learning different sides of a particular issue, which is also to validate Simone, like people do listen to, right? Like you're putting it out there because there is an audience of people that need to hear it.
All right, I agree with both those points. The key point here is that Judaism views it as a core element of being successful is study, practically what to do, but to feel inspired and motivated to do the right thing. For example, if you're going to teach your child to be honest in business or teach a student to be honest in business, that can't be just simply, you should not cheat. It can't be just a performa saying of the rule. It has to be modeling. Nor part of study is studying the excellent actions of your parents and your teachers. To learn, have role models of excellence. It's also part of study. The study is more grandiose. So the key point is that, in a certain sense, the Torah would turn toward, let's call it the left, and say, yes, your focus on getting better quality education in the public schools is critical because study leads to action. If you want to have a successful society, they need to be an educated society. So that's point number one. I'm running out of time, so let's go to the next part of the round. Okay, let's Sarah, do the next tomorrow. We're doing tomorrow tonight. Why not?
Rabbi Yehuda says, any father who does not teach his son a trade teaches him banditry? Okay. Yes. The Gemara expresses surprise at this statement. Can it enter your mind that he actually teaches him banditry? Rather, the bereta means that it is, I feel like I'm a Pesach Seder right now. Okay. Means that it is as though he teaches him banditry. Since the son has no profession with which to support himself, he is likely to turn to theft for a livelihood.
Good. So question number five, what important insight does the Gemara teach about the underlying cause of crime?
If you don't show them how to make a living, they'll figure it out on their own. And
will they?
Maybe not go the hard way. They'll take the easy way.
What is an obligation of a parent to a child, according to the Torah?
What is the Baraita?
The Baraita is a statement of in the Talmud. So they're clarifying that it's not being ignored. It's saying in a very exaggerated way. Any father that doesn't teach his kid a profession is talking to be a thief. So they're telling him, he's teaching him to be a thief. Actually, no, because if he's not going to be able to support himself, he's going to become. And he's going to turn to crime, because how else is he going to support himself?
It's a little extreme, right?
But that's the cause of all crime today. And if you think about it, a lot of people are in jail today, or they got into trouble with the law and in their life because they couldn't support themselves, in a law-abiding way. So it makes sense. The answer to crime is education.
Well, education, and specifically to be able to have certainly more
livelihood,
a livelihood, yeah. Be able to get a job, whether it be job training or to get a not just a high school diploma, but either trade or college degree, so then you can support yourself in a modern society. That, by the way, is not a nice thing to do. The Torah uses that's an obligation. The parent prime directive is to make sure your kid can become financially independent. That's an obligation. Now, obviously, you can't control everything. So what does that mean? So modern day, that means make sure your kid gets at least an undergraduate degree, at least, and gets direction of how to get a job. That's not a guarantee, of course, but that's a critical component. Because if a kid, if a person grows up and they can't support themselves, what do you want from them, ultimately? You're putting them in a bad situation. Obviously, the linkage between crime and poverty is not exactly unrelated. So...
highly related.
There we go. We have Professor Estola, and it's highly related.
That is it, like Daphne was saying. And hi, Daphne. I haven't seen you in a long
time. Oh, hi, Dean. How are you? Yeah, I know. I was just telling you on my fellowship. Oh, God, I missed that in those days.
The correlation of poverty and crime you can't ignore, but it's not as simple as that, because most poor people are not criminals. Do you know what I mean?
Correct.
Definitely something much...
Correct. That's why he's saying that the key word is he's likely to turn to crime, not necessarily.
Yeah.
Now, question follow-up. Now we have two pieces of the Talmud. Does the Gemara modify the Torah alone, bringing into proper action? In other words, the previous statement of the Talmud says, that study brings to proper action. And now we have another statement that says that, work is the good here. Or to put into question number seven, why is study alone insufficient to ensure honest behavior?
Wait, I have a question that answers this question. Some cases, and if you could talk about this too, I've written about this at length, going to like the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia and in Chicago, and really looking at the social dynamics. There are no men around. Mothers are leading households. They're about 20 years old with two or three kids. Yep. They're lucky to have a GED. So kids in these households who I've met and are super brilliant kids don't have family to say, get an internship, get into this great high school. Like, the direction isn't there. Does the Torah then say if a family fails to honor this obligation, then the community has to step up? Is that where we're going with this?
Well, that's not mentioned here, but what I'm sharing here is that education is great. It's insufficient. Job training is great. But you need both these components. In other words, just because a person knows what the right thing to do is, if they're in a very stressed situation, they're not necessarily going to necessarily act upon them. Which of course, and now takes us to our parsha. 45 minutes into class, we're finding the parsha. This is the parsha class.
Good.
Here we go. So the beginning of parsha kicks off. Let me hear from Suzanne. Take us into the parsha.
judges and justice. Appoint yourself judges and police for your tribes and all your settlements that God your Lord is giving you, and make sure that they administer honest judgment for the people. Do not bend.
Well, on a pause right there, because that's the main thing. So there's a mitzvah. Let's go to Rashi to explain that. Go ahead, check out Rashi. We're trying to squeeze everything in tonight.
Judges and police.
The Shoftim
are the judges who pronounce sentence, and Shoftim are those who chastise the people at the judge's order, beating and binding the recalcitrant with a stick and a strap until he accepts the judge's sentence.
Okay, so there is law enforcement, and that's the Shoftim's job. And we had a class when we were dealing with one of the, it's not limited, just to remind people that when the there'll be two judges, one in the court with the police. We call that in America a bailiff, to ensure that there is a proper, everything's done properly in the court, as far as if there has to be somebody who's unruly. And judges would go on patrol walking through the shuk, the marketplace, with a shoter, with a police officer, as Aram talks about. And if there had to be somebody brought in who was going to be recalcitrant or was, in fact, not listening to, who was caught, shall we say, cheating the people, the judge would order the police officer to give the person what they call in Yiddish a potch. You know what I mean? And they would do a little bit of a corporal punishment to get people doing the right thing. So the Torah, even though that we have education, and even though we have the centrality of having a job, it still requires us to have a police force, even in the most rarefied Jewish society. Torah and job alone do not produce social harmony. So what role does enforcement of the law play in maintaining honest behavior in society? And why isn't Torah study and skill in the use of profession not enough? And we know this from our whole experiences.
It protects people. It kind of keeps, you know.
But why can't, you know, the question is, why can't people police themselves? It goes to, as Simon mentioned, that there are people who want to abolish the police officers. Why does the Torah say that's insane? Why is that? Why can't good education and good jobs be enough for people to police themselves?
But then it wouldn't be like equal justice, right?
No, let everybody be a mensch. Let everybody act in a just way. Why is that?
Survival of the fittest, Darwinism, crime, right? The heart of a man is bad inside. Yetzirah, right? What's the Yetzirah, Rav?
Yetzirah, Ram, and Urav, as it says in Parshat Noah. That the evil inclination of man is from youth. It gets a head start. So bottom line is, we all know we have impulses, and we don't always do what we know is correct. Simple example, texting. We all know, we've all seen that texting while driving is dangerous. People have died because person looked down to answer a text, they think it's only gonna take a second, and then by the time they look up, they're in the back of somebody else's car and careening in at 60 miles an hour, and a tragedy occurs. Do they know that texting is wrong? Yes. But they're thinking, just for a second. You know, that you have an impulse, like somebody has a little beep, you want to look at it. You want to look at it, right? And so even though the person knows that texting in an abstract way is harmful, so therefore it's helpful to have New York State police officers pulling over people who are texting on the freeway, because it's going to save people's lives. Because even though that a person knows in abstract that this could be dangerous, people forget. People get overwhelmed, as Chaim pointed out, by their desires to, I want to look at the text. A warning, you know what I mean? Speeding. Would you imagine a freeway with no cops? How would that look like?
So
the Autobahn,
correct.
Which should be illegal. It's terrifying.
So therefore there is an element of a deterrent factor that even the most educated and well-employed people need. The bottom line is that we are not so good since we have it as a Yates or a Ra, as Hein points out. We need, shall we say, some external motivation to do the right thing, not to text and drive, not to speed. How about paying on taxes? Let's say the IRS would stop auditing a certain percentage of returns. How would that increase revenue for the United States government, or would that decrease revenue for the state of government, the United States Treasury? What do you guys think?
Oh my gosh, we'd be bankrupt next year.
We'd be bankrupt, because the bottom line is that I know in abstraction that the government, the United States, needs money to function. I know that I, as a citizen, should pay my share, but every person has 60 rationalizations in their mind why they deserve the money more than the United States government. They don't need it. They don't use it properly. They won't notice it. I need it more. Whatever the reasons are, so the bottom line, the person has to know the back end, if I mess around, if I put a couple deductions which are not justified, and I get audited, and there's no more fierce if you get audited from the IRS, we all know that is an unpleasant experience. So that's motivated that even if your co-education and the fact that you're well-employed is not going to be enough. You need that external motivation. Call authorities, call judges, call police. You can't remove that element. Let's keep on going. I'm going to now another spicy topic here. This is a wild case. Let me have Daphne, can you read it? It's Israel. Oh. Israel to Israel. Go ahead.
Okay. In an article from Arts, a rabbinical court has ordered the Egged Bus Cooperative to fire one of its employees because of his refusal to divorce his wife. The order issued by the Jerusalem Rabbinical Court last Thursday gave the company 30 days to comply.
Okay, so here's the case. We have an abusive husband, and he was, he was trying to use the get to extort money. By the way, this is a topic in its own right. Both men and women can use the get to extort money. Either A, the guy can't give the get, or the woman won't show up to the basin to receive the get. So in Israel right now, it's about 50-50 of bad actors, men and women. Okay, so since Eged is part of the state, therefore the rabbinical court can order Eged to fire a guy who's not refusing to show up to the basin and give his wife a get. Okay, let's get a little follow-up. Keep on going. Jerusalem Post, April 4th, not that long afterwards.
A physically abusive husband who refused to grant his wife a divorce, tried to extort money from her in the divorce proceedings, and absconded from legal proceedings, has finally agreed to the divorce after being fired from his job and arrested for failing to appear before a rabbinical court.
Okay, so the bottom line is, it worked. Okay? This guy is some piece of work. There are no words. There's no proper words for such a guy. But the bottom line is, he was threatened about losing his job. He didn't give the get. He had to, A, get fired. And if you can check out the article online, they had to hire, he ran away, didn't show up to the thing. They had to hire a private eye and found him. Then the police arrested him, schlepped him to Basin, and shall we say, he said, you know something? I have a desire to give my wife a gift. Okay. So where does this come from? No, we can't force people to get married. So how can you force somebody to give a get? Let's do a little learning here. Okay, so let me have Stephanie Bavakasha, Law of the Divorce. Mm-hmm. Bavakasha, take us on.
Wait, Daphne or Stephanie?
Stephanie.
Oh.
Okay. Why is this coerced get not null and void? For he is being compelled, either by Jews or by Gentiles, to divorce against his will, and a get must be given voluntarily. Because the concept of being compelled against one's will applies only when speaking about a person who is being compelled and forced to do something that the Torah does not obligate him to do, a person who is coerced until he consented to a sale or to give a present.
Right, so that case is not valid. So if you can't force somebody to, like a mafioso says, I want you to sell your house, sign the contract. That's considered not valid.
If, however, a person's evil inclination presses him to negate the observance of a mitzvah or to commit a transgression, and he was coerced until he performed the action he was obligated to perform, or he disassociated himself from the forbidden action, He is not considered to have been forced against his will. On the contrary, it is he himself who is forcing his own conduct to become debased. With regard to this person who outwardly refuses to divorce his wife, he wants to be part of the Jewish people, and he wants to perform all the mitzvot and eschew all the transgressions. It is only his evil inclination that presses him. Therefore, when he is coerced until his evil inclination has been weakened, and he consents to the divorce, he is considered to perform the divorce willfully.
Okay, this is dramatic stuff here.
Okay. Rabbi Pindi, why not use this logic to force Jews to keep Shabbat and keep kosher? And like, this is pretty, I mean, I've read this, it's pretty crazy.
Okay, so, okay, all right, we're, okay.
I mean,
I promised you guys a spicy Torah lesson. I'm delivering here, all right? Am I delivering? All right, let's take it slowly. Okay, Daphne, you're already three steps ahead of me. Okay, so what, let's just take it down a little slower here. What is the Torah's theory of explaining the misbehaviors of usually law-abiding citizens?
They're misguided. They know not what they do. We have to help them make the right choice.
Well, not that they don't know what they
do. No, they know. They're just not doing what they're supposed to be doing. But they know they're doing something wrong.
Right, correct. They know the students are wrong. And so why aren't they doing the right thing?
Well, the Yetzer Hara has this outsized influence on them.
Exactly. They're overwhelmed by their powerful emotions. For example, this guy, he wants to use the get as a tool of extortion. His wife has money. He says, I'll give you the get. I want 50 grand. You know he's got to give the get, but he loves 50 grand more, and he doesn't love her anymore. So, and also there's an enjoyment of taking revenge. So his yetzer hara of being a vengeful, greedy bastard, okay, that's the technical definition, is overwhelming his sense that his inner sense of right and wrong is he's being overwhelmed. So therefore, the court did what? It says, okay, we're going to have you have some time to think about that. How about being unemployed? Boop. How about having the police schlep your tuchus to the basin? Boop. Somehow, he had an amazing epiphany. And he recognized that he needed a little help because he was doing what he should have done naturally and organically. And that's that. Just as a little postscript. At MGE, we do weddings. One of the things that we do is that we do not perform a wedding unless the couple signs a halachic prenup, which basically says that either if the husband or wife separates and is called by either one to show up at a basin for a get. If either one refuses, each one will be obligated $150 per day. The clock starts at $55,000 a year to not show up. If the woman refuses, she starts having to pay $150. And it's enforceable. It's a contract which is enforceable in the United States. So therefore, why should they need that? Because when, as we all know, divorced people, when people get divorced, they go from love to hate, they drink a whole bucket of crazy, and sometimes you need external motivation to do the right thing. So this is supposed to be a rare circumstance. Usually, the Torah should have been enough to do the right thing, or people encouraging the person to do the right thing. But there has to be a case where the person has to be, shall we say, motivated. And
wait, can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
So where do we draw the line, right? So I understand you're saying this is a rare case. So Kamala Harris got flack this week. NPR reviewed her San Francisco DA, and she arrested parents who allowed their kids to be truants. Kids weren't going to school, so as the DA in San Fran, she arrested the parents. So that's using the courts to force people to serve a certain action. So, like, what is the Torah? Like, who are we to say this guy isn't in the right? Like, we're using force to make someone behave away.
So, in other words, this is not the first step. In other words, there's a whole process of when the court decides that a get must be given. It's obviously in very extreme circumstances. So, you know, for example, let's say the person's just sleeping around and not supporting his wife and kids. Let's say, for example, then the basic order that he has to give her a get. And let's say he says, fine, I'll give a get, but I want $50,000. So then the basin in Jerusalem says, we're going to get you fired. You know what I mean? In other words, there are times where, there are always going to be cases of gray. But there are rare circumstances that a person, there needs to be coercion. Because people get crazy and they do, and there has to be a time, rare, but it has to be, as David pointed out, that a person is held hostage by the HRA, and has to be then has to be subdued. Now obviously can that be abused? Of course, but we're not here. We're talking about the principle. So, for example, and also by texting. In other words, the person knows there has to be texting, but most municipalities have been progressively ranking, increasing. How many points do you lose when you're caught texting? How big is the fine? Now, why are they doing that? Because people are dying. And you're not going to wait till people have this epiphany that I shouldn't text and drive. Because the thing is like this, I'll just give you, everybody spelt this, and if you don't, you're not being fully honest. Your car comes to the red light. What do? You might pick up your phone and look at what's going on. And then you might stop, the desire, we're addicted to our phones. So the fact is there has to be a better a consequence to, shall we say, subdue our HRA. So I'm already in the overtime, so I want to sort of wrap up the whole point. The reality is the terrorist says to the left, yes, education is primary. Yes, you got to have a job. And those social services that need to help people who do not have those things is critical, because you can't police your way to social harmony. That's not going to work. That is not going to work. Having said that, to the left, the terrorist says, to the right, says, you can't just have abusive or a totalitarian police state. That's also not going to work. You need to be able to provide education, provide social, but people are not going to naturally do their own thing. Again, the police, by and large, do not cause violence. There are people who are violent. They need to be dealt with. They need to be subdued at the proper time. Now, again, obviously they have to be trained. In the terrorist system, as I mentioned in the last class, the police officer is not allowed to do any expression of force unless the okay of the dayan, of the judge, which is that's why they go together. Now, that's a very, in America, that would not be practical, but or getting a higher level of education, whatever the way to better to deal with that, of course, would be in the right way. So to get rid of police, it's a mitzvah to have police, number one. So it's a mitzvah to have police, law enforcement, and a good judicial system, and not just for Jews. Part of the seventh mitzvah of Noach is to do what? Is that they must establish courts, okay? And that means also to have a police. So it's a mitzvah for Jews, and non-Jews for non-Jews. Mm-hmm. So the Torah is no matter how refined the moral fabric and character a person is, everybody knows themselves that we all get overwhelmed. We act stupid, we act silly, and having an external factor in our life, in some cases the police, is critical for the well-being of the society. Now, and speaking to both Stephanie's point and Simone's point, yes, obviously it has to be done intelligently. And just to go back to Stephanie's other point, and it should be done based upon research and expert opinion, and not by people screaming in the streets to fund the police. That is a terrible way to make decisions. Any significant decision should be done by expert opinion and by getting a clear consensus, and not by being bullied either from the right or to the left of what should be done. That's not an intelligent way. The Torah is about wisdom, about intelligence, both in our own life and how to run the society, and that has to be done intelligently. So this is a massive topic. I had people tell me offline, Rabbi, I can't believe you're going to do this. Uh-huh. This is like, Rabbi, you're touching the third rail. I said, if we can't talk about the most important subjects which happening in our society and share it from a Torah lens, then you're making Torah irrelevant. So, and I want to congratulate everybody. I think everybody spoke with dignity with wisdom. And I think that I think it was a good conversation tonight. I know I learned a great deal. I hope everybody else felt the same way. And we should continue to have many more conversations.
Definitely. I think this is a great class.
It was great. Thank you so much, Rabbi Pini.
Thank you. Simone and Stephanie and Dr. David Grant for sharing their tremendous opinions and insights and expertise. And I think it lifted everything up. So Yasha Kodak, you all.
All good points.
Thank you so much for joining.
All right, guys. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Bye, Rabbi.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye, everyone.